Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2974 creates two additional exemptions to requirements for scenic highways under the Forest Practices Act. The first is harvest within an urban growth boundary, and second is harvest within zones designated for rural residential development. There is no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal, no statement was issued, and there's no subsequent.
So any...
Mr. Chair, I'll make a motion that we move House Bill 2974 to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Representative Smith has moved House Bill 2974 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I just would like to say that I had asked the question about if DLCD had any comments, so I appreciate the fact that Penny staff did follow up, and I did get an email from DLCD, and I don't know if you handed that out.
I think almost everybody got the email. It came to
Okay, all. So I appreciate you following up on that. Thank you. That helped answer my question.
Thank you.
Whenever it talks about, you know, state land use planning goals, I just like to know.
I appreciate that, too. Any other discussion or questions? Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote.
You
already did the motion.
Did you do the motion?
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Those in favor say aye. Those opposed, no.
Representative Belford?
Excuse.
Representative Clark?
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Mouse?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Chair Robles?
Aye. Having received the... constitutional majority, it is now passed. And
Chair, I move that we put this House bill on the consent calendar.
Anyone have any objections to it being on the House consent calendar? Seeing none, so we will order.
Okay.
So thank you, and we will close our work session on 2974, and we'll open a hearing on 2975. We had begun that, and I want to thank all those people for returning. So should we go in this order? Okay, we have a panel that we're going to start with. David, and we have some news. We'll check on that, too. David, Ivan, and Joe, come on up, representing the Sierra Club, Wild Salmon Center, and Oregon.
Oregon Trout.
Trout. So be sure. Oh, and before we get started, if anyone has a cell phone in the on position, make sure that it's turned off, not just in the other, because it'll pick up on our mics and stuff, and it is kind of distracting at times. With that, I'll let you introduce yourselves and whichever way you want to go.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Whitworth. I'm Director of Oregon Trout. And our board of directors and more than 4,000 members and supporters across the state, thank you for the opportunity to comment on House Bill 2975. The mission of our organization is to protect and restore wild fish and their ecosystems, and for nearly a quarter of a century, we've made a reputation of finding good working solutions that last. Like many in this room, I find it unfortunate that we are here today. Though recent sessions have put this body in the habit of reviewing the definition of greatest permanent value from time to time, as it relates to forest management, these have been largely driven by short-term politics rather than long-term solutions. And today is no different. Oregon law states, for the purposes of state forests, that they are required to be managed for the greatest permanent value. The greatest permanent value has been defined in OAR to mean healthy, productive, and sustainable forest ecosystems that over time and across the landscape provide a full range of social, economic, environmental benefits to the people of Oregon. Oregon Trout was an active participant in the development of the Northwest Oregon State Forest Management Plan, working with all the stakeholders, the Department of Forestry, and others in hammering out a management plan to achieve the economic, environmental, and social and recreational benefits as described by Phase Permanent Value. This plan was developed over a 7-year process and reflects public and stakeholder input, state and federal statutes, and scientific review. With the full unanimous support of the counties, interested stakeholders, and representatives of the citizens of Oregon, this forest management plan was adopted in 2001 by the Board of Forestry. House Bill 2975 equates to an end run around a lengthy substantive process that resulted in the final adoption of the management plan currently in place and working. To allow a single bill to undo all that due diligence would stand to undermine the credibility of certainly that document, and I would say the Oregon legislature, particularly at a time when the public has asked for more solutions and less politics. Since the plan's adoption, we have actively engaged with ODF to ensure successful implementation of the Forest Management Plan. Oregon Trout sits as a member of the State Forest Advisory Committee and serves on the State Forest Advisory Committee membership, selection committee, along with representatives of the counties and the timber industry. Additionally, we work with ODF, the county stakeholders, legislatively directed citizen work group to create to do a review of salmon anchor habitats, which essentially provides for not just aquatic species water quality, but also getting the cutout in a balanced way. Those were the first in the country to have happened, and they're just in process and working now. In 2006, ODF commissioned an independent third-party review around greatest permanent value. I have a copy of it here in pertinent part, and I'll provide that. But in essence, we're on track to achieve greatest permanent value by following our forest management plan. We're not there yet. We're on track to get there. Over the past 15 years, we have worked hard to find balance on state forest management. Oregon Trout did not support ballot measure 34, the 50-50 campaign recently, much to the criticism of our environmental colleagues. Instead, we worked with ODF and other interests to continue down the road of this forest management plan and work on the salmon anchor habitats to really figure out if there was a better way to run the railroad, as it were. Interestingly, one of the county's arguments in opposition to that measure was that the petitioners had participated in the development of the FMP and supported its adoption, only later to come back seeking to undo the balance that had thoughtfully been put in place during the 7-year FMP process. HB 2975 puts the counties in exactly the same position they once denounced. The issue before you now is driven by politics and the social welfare of Oregon counties affected by state forest lands. It's not about the biological or management elements of sound forest practices. We're aware of the current crisis facing county road education, public employee budgets due to federal county payments legislation and its impasse in Congress. The real solution, however, does not involve scrapping a substantive process and the conservation values that a balanced approach to state forest management includes. There is no mistaking. I mean, I spend a lot of time in these, in this landscape. I've fished the Trask last weekend. There is no mistaking at all that these landscapes have been and will continue to be heavily logged. They're working landscapes, and the cultural default is set to logging. Under the current implementation of the FMP, the state forest management is achieving that GPV. A bill like this puts us on a backward course to the timber wars and the salmon wars that we have only just emerged from. So I would State forest lands are owned by all of Oregonians, and they need to be managed according to a wide variety of public values. This becomes more and more true over time as coastal communities grow, recreational uses increase, and salmon recovery plans get implemented to the tune of millions of state dollars, and federal dollars, for that matter. I should say hundreds of millions of state and federal dollars. While we do not object to timber production being one of the overall public values on these lands, if passed, this bill would not only remove any hope of retaining the permanent values of the state forest lands, it would work at direct cross purposes with state taxpayer and lottery player money that are being put on the ground to the benefit of habitat and water quality throughout the state through the Oregon plan. Additionally, put at risk is the tenuous amount of trust that the conservation community is trying to put into local decisions around natural resources. As you all know, the historic environmental default has been set against trusting local decisions because they have historically been made for short-term gain, primarily economic, sometimes political. That this bill is in front of you today is an example of the powerful political forces of short-term thinking. No informed public official can say that they thought that federal timber payments would last forever. Still, few can say they led the way in planning ahead. This event gives you the chance to do exactly that. So rather than just upping the cut and setting off another greatest permanent value firestorm that sends our forest policy backward, if the committee wants to positively address the social and revenue conditions in state forest counties, it has a few options beyond the one on the table for consideration. It could revisit the formula by which revenues from state forest timber sales are allocated to find a more sustainable ratios for counties with those who harvest timber for profit within their boundaries. It could look at slash waste streams or sustainable thinning projects for renewable energy sources and plug into the forward-thinking renewable power standard legislation that's moving right now. It could build from this example a platform to grapple with the real revenue needs of this state going forward as it moves into the future. There are a few others that are available, and I would hope that as a member and the director of Oregon Drought, I would urge you to oppose this bill but use it as an opportunity to do some things that are proactive as opposed to reactive for the state of Oregon. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And I've got a few things for Mr. Penn.
We'll let you all go first, and then we'll ask questions. Does that work for people? Okay.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is David Moskowitz, and I'm here today speaking on behalf of the Wild Salmon Center. Wild Salmon Center is an international salmon conservation organization based in Portland, Oregon, and it works in North America as well as in Russia, working to protect the last best places for salmon. And the Tillamook, the Oregon North Coast, is one of those places. I have a few slides that I'd like to go through, and maybe if we can dim the lights just briefly, it will give us a better view. So this is a view from space of the Oregon North Coast. You can see the Columbia River to the north. You can see the lower end is Tillamook Bay, and you can see the dark lines of the Tillamook Forest, and as you move north to the Clatsop Forest and to the far right, you can see parts of Forest Grove and Hillsboro. But it's a virtual sea of green. And it's an incredible place to grow trees. And that has been the issue that citizens of Oregon have been very focused on. The Tillamook is perhaps one of the most visible pieces of land, notable pieces of land anywhere, originally owned by private timber companies, both family companies and larger, and many of those lands that were owned by private companies were foreclosed upon by the counties in the 20s during the Great Depression, a series of fires that happened afterwards left these lands in pretty tough shape. And it wasn't just the fires. We're talking about a landscape of about 520,000 acres in the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forest. Overall, in Northwest State Forest, it's over 600,000. That includes the Sandy Am and a couple other places. The fires consumed or burned parts of over 200,000 acres, but it was the salvage logging and road building to take out some of that burned and some of the green wood afterwards that left the landscape really devastated in many respects. But nature is very resilient, as we all know, and it's a great story today. This picture's of watersheds in the Trask on the coast. And this line, you can see the line that is in the upper left corner shows the line between private and state lands. And it does show something about the rate of harvest and how these lands are being managed. But really, this issue before you today is not necessarily jobs versus fish or fishing. Because in the Tillamook, you actually can have both. And it is the home of probably the most globally important Chinook salmon, one of the most globally important runs of Chinook salmon that come into Tillamook and New Halen Bay. A wide degree of genetic and biological diversity, some very great abundance, many different life histories. It's really a fantastic place for salmon. Particularly the fall Chinook and the steelhead and the cutthroat, coho and spring Chinook are on the rebound, but this place and chum salmon are there as well. It's an incredible place and offers a lot for Oregonians. And these fish are coming out of streams that are born on the slopes, the Coast Range, on state public lands. And the amazing thing is, with nature's resilience and hopefully human help, the forest is coming back and the watersheds continue to heal. And that is what the Board of Forestry has been trying to accomplish over the past few years with this management plan. And it started in 1994. I just want to briefly touch on an issue that Representative Dinkfelder raised. She asked about the public involvement. This document here is the forest plan that the board adopted in 2001. The history of public involvement starts in, it's so long ago, all I can say is early 1994. No one knows the date for sure because it was so long ago. But it goes on for 5 pages till adoption. And the public was greatly involved in this plan. Recently, the Department of Forestry hired a public polling organization, and they conducted a poll of Oregonians. And they actually polled over 1,000 Oregonians, so this is kind of, the margin of error is pretty small on this. It's more people than would be polled in most political polls. And they asked the question, what do you value state forests most for? What are the most important things that come from the state forest? And this is Department of Forestry hired this firm to do this polling. And there's your top answer. 87% of people said they valued the state forest for clean water. 82% for wildlife habitat. 78% for fish habitat. Hiking or viewing wildlife, 71%. Having recreation areas on the state forest, 65%. Timber, 63%. Campground, 62%. And places for off-highway vehicles at 19%. But you can see there's a wide range of values that citizens of Oregon view that are important coming from the state forest. This poll was reported on. This is the Oregonian had a big story on, the title is Forest Playgrounds or Cash Crop, and it was just before the election, November 1st, that they referred to this study. And I'm sure the department, I've tried to come by my copy of that, but I couldn't, but I'm sure the department could provide it for you, because it's very interesting. It's a wide range of questions they asked of Oregonians. As we just talked about, the current FMP, the Forest Management Plan, is a result of years of planning, stakeholder involvement, In the middle of it was a rulemaking on determining what the greatest permit value was. And that's where they come up with the three legs of the stool, with the social, the economic, and the environmental aspects of this plan. That's the three legs of the stool. And they're co-equal. The board adopted the plan in January 2001, and most people, no one was happy with this plan at the time. That was, I think that's a common place that agencies find themselves when they actually adopt a plan or adopt a rule. Rarely is everybody satisfied. And I think that was the case. I know that environmental groups were sad about the lack of permanent reserves to protect salmon, among other things. The counties and the industry may have not been satisfied with the harvest range, but yet the board took an action that it was authorized to do under statute. The board delegated the authority to do the implementation plan to the state forester. And in March of 2003, the Department of Forestry presented their implementation plan for the forest. And that was the time when the harvest targets, the range of harvest was set. That's when the salmon anchor habitats were put in place. That next summer, the legislature, there was a budget note that went in and directed the department to go take another look at their planning process, at the numbers they used. And they also asked to take a look at the salmon anchor habitats. And I sat on a task force that the governor appointed of a wide range of interest groups to look at that plan. But basically, they set the department back to work to review all the numbers. And the result of that is the habitat harvest and habitat model project. So this is a document that just came out in early 2006. And it was a very careful look at the conditions in the forest, and they tried to model what harvest levels could be. But basically, the results were not what was anticipated. And one of the main reasons was is that inventory data used by the Department of Forestry in the habitat and harvest modeling study from 2003 to 2006 was much better. It used real inventories. It used forester-generated inventory, stand inventories. The sessions model that was used to base the forest plan on in 2000 and 2001 was a computer model based on aerial photographs. And there were a lot of problems with that data. The second effort used a lot better data. And what they found was that there are actually fewer trees growing on these forests. Fewer trees, they were growing slower than expected. And also the site conditions were poorer than were anticipated. And those three things led the department to revise the harvest targets. Now I'll just show you what they were. In the implementation plan from the Department of Forestry in 2003 was 140 million board feet to 225 million board feet. And for the past number of years, the department has been aiming at that high level because of that budget note. The revised range brought the minimum up, but it also took the high end down a little bit. And this year, the target is 184 million board feet. So it is a decline. If you recall, Commissioner Labhart talked about that with the chart on his testimony. He showed the dip. But if the department had been following the plan without the budget note, we probably wouldn't have seen that up and down cycle. Part of the reason that we're here today is that the counties and perhaps some of the industry felt they wanted higher harvest targets. And that was a result of this computer model from John Sessions from Oregon State University, who's considered the top of his game, and he's the best person there is on this topic. But using it, he only can be as good as the data he had to start with. He can only be that good. And based on that, he projected that you could harvest at sustainably a level of 279 million board feet, based on this computer-generated model. That number has been fixated upon by the counties and some members of the industry. And it's simply not achievable because there are fewer trees, the site conditions are less favorable, and the trees are growing slower. And yet we're being asked, everybody talks about slippage. That was the word that was used last Thursday. There's slippage in the plan. We need to correct this. Well, that's an imaginary slippage because it's based on a number that's too high. And the department has placed reasonable harvest targets out there based on real inventories by real foresters. Based on some of the harvest levels, so I've already talked about that. The 279 million board feet, it's overstated by 24% compared to the high end now. And it's unrealistic. I'm sorry, I'm kind of repeating myself here. Apologize. One of the drivers, though, with that high harvest level, all the economists were predicting how much economic impact could be created from timber harvest on this forest. And part of that is based on employment. And those forecasts are too high. The U.S. Forest Service and economists at OSU estimate there are 12.7 direct and indirect timber jobs per million board feet harvested. Okay, the facts don't support that. And we can look at an example right on the Tillamook in a specific time frame. In 1995, there were 80 million board feet of timber harvested from the forest. By 2000, that number had doubled to 160 million board feet. So if you take the figure of 12.7 jobs and multiply that by the doubling of the cut, you should have created about over 1,000 jobs statewide. Okay. If you look at the Department of Revenue's Department of Employment's figures, though, and if you were to divide that by 36 counties in Oregon, you'd have at least 28 jobs in every county. And, of course, that's probably not happening from this wood being harvested in northwest Oregon. You probably aren't creating 28 jobs in Lakeview or Burns. But the state's own data show during that five-year period when harvest doubled, there were 4 direct or indirect wood product jobs created in Clatsop County, and there were 12 in Tillamook County. Now, the largest purchaser of state forest trees is Hampton Industries, and they have a mill in Tillamook. They have their biggest mill, I believe, is in Willamina. If you assume that there's 3 times that many jobs created in Willamina, it still doesn't get you anywhere close to the number of jobs that are being touted by the cutting of trees in Oregon. And the reasons for this, and I think everybody knows this, and it's technology is a big part of it. We have, and it's also the condition of the stands of forests. We have a young forest in the Tillamook. We have a lot of young forests in northwest Oregon. It doesn't take as many loggers to log the land because the trees aren't as big and because the equipment is more technological. With a feller or cutter loader and a log truck, 2 people can harvest acres and acres. Hampton Industries is using new technology every year in their mill. They're putting out more timber from their mills than ever before, and oftentimes with fewer people because they have better equipment. And this change in the industry affects how many jobs these harvests might create. Now, ODF has a slightly different figure for job growth, and their own report in 1996 found that 44% of the logs cut in the state forest were processed by local mills in those 3 counties. 53% of logs went elsewhere. Their research shows that between 2.2 and 2.8 local wood products jobs are associated with each million board foot cut. So if you take those same figures and look at that doubling between 1995 and 2000, when the cut went from 80 million to 160, take 44% of it used in those 3 counties, that means they're processing about 35 million board feet times the 2.5 local wood products jobs. It said there should be 88 jobs, direct and indirect jobs, created in that period. Those jobs were not created by that doubling, according to the state's own data in those counties. Okay. It's pie in the sky. These are real jobs.
these 16 jobs that were created are important jobs in these counties, and I'm not trying to undermine that, but I'm saying that the number of jobs and the corresponding economic growth associated with increased harvest is simply not there. And this is important because the Oregon's counties on the North Coast have very diverse economies already. And during when the Northwest Forest Plan was adopted in the 90s, it created a crisis in many Oregon counties. As part of that disaster relief, the federal government had to assess all Oregon counties on the west side to find out if they were timber dependent, because if they were timber dependent, they would qualify for disaster relief. And in that review, Clatsop County and Tillamook County were not found to be timber dependent. And the reason is because you have large sectors of other industries there, agriculture being prime among them, but fishing and tourism and the transfer of wealth from people who are moving there because of the natural resource values and amenities. They're moving to the North Coast. They're entrepreneurs that are starting small businesses, and they're bringing wealth to those counties. What I'd like to do, and I appreciate your indulgence in my long time, and I sat in the room on Thursday and listened to a lot of testimony for a long time, and I really wanted to take my time going through this, and I'm looking forward to questions and also for my colleagues to finish theirs. But I do want to get down to what do we want? Why are we here, and should we be here? The Board of Forestry has the ability to review this plan. And in this document they adopted in 2001, they have a section called Plan Duration. It's on page 5-3, on the final plan, chapter 5, page 3. And there's an OAR that requires the Board of Forestry to review the plan every 10 years. This plan was adopted in 2001, so presumably they would conduct a review either just before or starting around 2011. In this implementation section of this plan, it talks about the discretion that the state forester has to make changes to this plan to account for changes in information. Department of Forestry, the industry, conservation groups, academic groups are all finding more information about the health of the forest, about the health of the natural resources there. And all that information is being processed by State Forester Brown's staff. And they have the administrative and statutory authority to address the issues that the counties have placed before you in this bill. And I believe in State Forester Brown's own testimony, or at least in a letter to you on last Tuesday, they stated that they are currently undergoing a serious review right at this moment. And this was a major topic of the board just back in the beginning of the month. And they have several other meetings in this spring and early summer where they are addressing this issue. The Wild Salmon Center, which has been very active on the state forest, and they were a proponent of Measure 34, which called for protecting half of the forest for fish, wildlife, clean water, and recreation. And that measure was defeated 62% to 38%, but it meant 38% of Oregonians wanted to see half this forest protected for fish, wildlife, and clean water. 62% of Oregonians said they bought the county and industry line that said, let's stick with the plan, let's let the department implement this plan. 62% of Oregonians said that in Measure 34. So we are here before you today, 3 years after Measure 34, in exactly the opposite place, which is an interesting place to be. But Wild Salmon Center would urge the committee to not pass this bill and let the Board of Forestry do its work under the schedule that's there, under the plan they adopted, with wide public involvement and indeed the support of environmentalists, the counties, and the industry, at least to the point where they could have adopted a plan in 2001. I thank you very much. I look forward to questions.
Thanks, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ivan Molesky. I'm the conservation coordinator for the Oregon Chapter Sierra Club. I appreciate the comments of my two previous colleagues. I think it was very informative and compelling, and brought a lot to bear that we didn't get to hear last week. The Oregon Chapter Sierra Club has almost 24,000 members in Oregon. The bulk of our membership, over 10,000 folks, lives between the North Coast and Hood River. A lot of them live in communities that literally border or get their drinking water from the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forests. So our members have a strong interest in the protection of certain values in these lands and in the management of these important public resources. Many thousands of our members living in Washington County in communities such as Beaverton, Forest Grove, Tualatin, and Hillsboro get their drinking water from watersheds that originate in these coastal forests, which we often refer to as the Tillamook Rainforest, Oregon's rainforest. Many more of our members from throughout the region utilize these unique public forests for recreational opportunities such as hiking, fishing, hunting, camping, mountain biking. And as a result, we are here to testify today in opposition to House Bill 2975. So with some 330 miles of fish-bearing streams, the Tillamook Rainforest supports important runs of coho, chum, spring, and fall Chinook salmon, as well as summer and winter steelhead and sea-run cutthroat trout. Most of these fish populations have declined sharply. The Tillamook still boasts six of the healthiest runs of wild fall Chinook in the lower 48 states and the healthiest population of winter steelhead on the northern Oregon coast. These forests are a stronghold for salmon. Many other mammals, migratory birds, amphibians, and reptiles make their home in the Tillamook Rainforest. 40 species are considered potentially sensitive by the state of Oregon, and threatened and endangered species living in the forest include the northern spotted owl, marbled murrelet, and the bald eagle. The Tillamook and Clatsop Forests, as Dave's slide helped illustrate, are literally an island of biodiversity surrounded by a sea of industrial forest land, which is managed with short rotation aggressive forestry, steep float logging, with hardly any protection for any remaining trees or streams. And the Tillamook Rainforest is essentially the only significant block of public land between the population centers in Portland area and the coast. As a result, the management of the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forest really is a showcase for what we're doing here in Oregon to the world. When people come and visit, they come to Portland, they go to the coast, and if they see a sea of clear cuts out there, that really reflects poorly on Oregon's forest management practices. And I want to be clear with something here. The Sierra Club is not trying to end logging on the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forest. We were supporters of Measure 34. Unfortunately, our side was outspent massively by the opposition. I do want to make that clear, that we are comfortable with sustainable harvest from the Tillamook to support counties and schools. We're completely comfortable with that. There's Swiss needle cast outbreaks, which are part of a problem when you plant a monoculture. You inevitably get disease. And there's just monoculture Douglas fir stands that do need some management and thinning. But I do want to say we do have problems with the current forest management plan, including the fact that it allows 120-acre clear cuts. We think that's a little too large. We believe that some areas should, in fact, be set aside as permanent no-logging zones to allow for the regrowth of the kinds of massive coast range old-growth forests that Lewis and Clark stood in awe of when they wintered on the North Coast just 200 years ago. So these forests really are an Oregon jewel. They represent Oregon. And while there is value in accommodating sustainable logging, and again, we do support that, there are other values, such as clean water, fish and wildlife, and recreation, that are just as important. And frankly, valued more, I believe, by Oregonians than just the timber segment for these forests. Dave already mentioned the poll, so I will gloss over that. I will say that in my testimony, I give you a reference for the poll that the Oregon Department of Forestry completed in just 1 year ago, March-April 2006. And it was called Oregon Residents and State Forest Stakeholders Knowledge of Values Regarding Attitude Towards Natural Resource Management in Oregon State Forests. And it talks about their methodology. The last page of my testimony actually is the graph showing where people were at in terms of those polls. And again, clean water, wildlife, and fish ranked higher, the highest in terms of the values that people hold most dear for these forests. And I think the take-home message from that poll is that Oregonians do support the current definition of greatest permanent value, which is by statute defined as, quote, healthy, productive, and sustainable forest ecosystems that over time and across the landscape provide a full range of social, economic, and environmental benefits to the people of Oregon. I believe, and the Sierra Club believes, that House Bill 2975 simply rejects this public sentiment and puts timber production above all other values. There's a big definition between a primary and the primary. You heard a lot of talk last week from some of the county commissioners that they felt that because there's been previous decisions that say that logging is a primary use of these forests, that means that you should interpret it as the primary. Well, there's a huge difference there. We disagree. If you put logging first above all other values, it is going to have very real impacts on the clean water, fish, wildlife, and recreation values that Oregonians clearly place a high value on for their state forests. So, again, you know, hundreds of thousands of Oregonians get their drinking water from these forests. There's commercial and recreational value associated with the healthy fisheries both inland and off the coast. And there are important high-tech jobs that are associated with the clean water coming out of these forests as well. That's part of the economic activity, I think, that's associated that sometimes gets overlooked. So the tough compromises and balances struck in the forest management plans for these forests would be abandoned if you all pass out House Bill 2975. And this would definitely benefit a few in the short term, but it would come at a great cost to many Oregonians. So we're urging you to please reject House Bill 2975. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions for our panel? I just had one that I'll ask. The Sessions model, which apparently people believe was off now by 24% or so on, was that information used during all the public testimony and discussions about that the counties were involved in when they were making the decision to go along with this plan with an assumption that might be the expected revenue from those forests? Because it sounds like that was a model that took place in about 1991. It sounds like the public testimony was between 91 and 93. So I guess my concern is if people have an expectation that something's going to happen and they enter into negotiations with people and everybody agrees with those kind of numbers as they go through that discussion, and then as soon as the discussion is over, the number changes to $100 million less than that, that might have made it part of the reason that they were in agreement at the time. That's my concern, I guess. Do you know about that, if you were involved in that discussion?
Chair Roland, I'll let Dave as well talk, and members of the committee. One thought there. I think this comes back to that question of we have to base these things in reality. I the on-the-ground realities of what foresters were able to come up with after they field-checked the forest is much more accurate about what expectations should be than modeling based on satellite photos. You know, and I think that Representative Witt, who testified last week, I thought had some very compelling comments in this regard. It is problematic whenever you set numbers for people, you begin to set expectations and peg expectations. We have to look at what is sustainable across the board, and I think that ultimately is borne out when you have facts on the ground and not just models. So, and Dr. Sessions is no environmentalist. I mean, I'll tell you, with the biscuit logging plan, his models predicted far more than what we would ever have been able to support in that situation. So, you know, it cuts both ways, and we need to be able to be a little bit flexible and adaptive as this plan is.
Chair Roblin, in answer of your question, looking at the forest plan the board adopted in 2001, in their chronology of public involvement, March of 2000, the Board of Forestry meeting and workshop, review of Sessions' decadal analysis of alternatives and report on Northwest FMP's connection to local economies. So that gives me some sense. I was not there, so I can't answer that question personally. But I think the staff and Board of Forestry could probably answer that question for you today. But I think this gives us an indication that it was fairly contemporaneous, that the Sessions information was used within a year, less than a year before the board adopted that. And but I think I'll try to get an answer for you, but I think the department staff may be able to answer that question for you today.
Representative Burla. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess just a couple things to, you know, the numbers based on some of the testimony we were provided last week, if you were to manage these forests using the Forest Practice Act standards, it's estimated about 320 million board feet per year, and that is a sustainable level. Okay, it's a standard that the environmental community can't agree with. The Board of Forestry, in January 2001, when they approved this plan, it was 279 million feet per year. That's also sustainable. but what's being managed at is 180. Now, that's about $36.5 million in revenue that's lost between the 279 and 180 million feet. Now, $36.5 million is about one-fourth of what we need to fully fund state troopers. Okay, so it's a respectable amount of money. But the question that I have, and what I'm trying to reconcile when I listen to you, is, you know, the industry's changed a great deal. It's not like it used to be, obviously. But, you know, we've got mills now that are having to barge logs in from Canada. We were hauling logs from New Zealand into Prineville. And yet here we've got some of the best growing timberland, certainly in the United States, if not the world. And we're not taking advantage of it. And when you look at numbers like $36.5 million off of lands that are held in trust for the counties, something's wrong with this picture. So, you know, give me your thoughts on that. I'm curious. How do we?
It's $36 million out of how many? How many million dollars are actually stripped off those lands every year?
According to this, the Board of Forestry approved plan at 279 million feet with an average of $365 per thousand stumpage is $101,835,000.
So $100 million is coming off the lands right now. Is that, I mean, I'm...
No, that's what the plan would do, but the implementation level, which is lower than that, is $65 million using the same stumpage figure.
Well, I think those are big numbers to throw around, Representative Burley, I think. And if you use that construction of the argument of this $36 million we're leaving in the ground is costing us one quarter of our state troopers. I mean, that's good social math, but I think we're also getting a lot of dollars off of that land. And I think that to say that we're not getting that next last little margin that could be, could buy that quarter of state troopers, I think that it's still, you know, there's $100 million that's coming off. And so we are getting revenues off. The 180 million board feet is also a sustainable number. It's not the perhaps maximally sustainable number as defined by, you know, whomever, you know, is defining it. But I think that there are other ways to get dollars for state troopers. And I think that, you know, if this is the only place to go, and the only way to do this is to take on or sort of come around a legislative or an input process without much input, I think that you're going to leave a lot of other Oregonian values on the table. And I think the world's changed since 1930 pretty dramatically. I don't think you could do coast-to-coast flights in 1930. We didn't have a man on the moon. The operating budget for the counties was far smaller. The technology that was available to timber in its harvest was far lesser. And so we're doing all these things in a way that is moving forward as opposed to moving back, partly because that's the way time works, and partly because the world's changed because people in Oregon are changing. I mean, we all know that timber built this state. It's still, number one or two in terms of revenue that come across, or come into the coffers. And I think that, you know, one of the things that could be on the table is looking at that revenue mix. I mean, I don't think you probably won't hear a county commissioner suggesting that to timber, but I think if you're looking for equity and you're looking for services and the state isn't willing to take on its, you know, how its tax structures work, then, you know, you've got to look at everything on the table, it seems to me.
Yeah, if I could respond, Chair Roblin, Representative Burley, I'd like to just comment on a couple of things you said. I think you are getting at an issue. I'm going to comment on the little things first and then come back to, I think, the key issue. The 320 million board feet at the FPA level, which you describe as sustainable, and you say the environmentalists are not, we just can't stand the standard. Well, we aren't the only ones. The Environmental Protection Agency and DEQ say that the Forest Practices Act does not protect beneficial uses under the Clean Water Act.
Okay, it's not an adequate standard to protect clean water in this state. So that's not me saying that. That is the EPA regional administrator saying that to the Board of Forestry. So I think that calls into question whether $320 million under the FPA is sustainable or achievable without harming other resources. The big issue you raise is, you talked about having to go out of state for mills, and Dave Eidenhoff from Hampton talks about that. He talks about that every single time. And he talks about these mills that are being built in Washington that are going to intercept the logs that have been coming to support Oregon mills. And I think that the industry, that's a problem for the industry, so it automatically is a problem for the state. However, it's not going to be solved in the backs of the state forest. This pamphlet is from the Department of Forestry. It's a Oregon State Forest Lands Achieving Greatest Permanent Value, and it's got a lot of different graphics, but it has a very interesting one in the very beginning, and actually State Forester Brown reminded me of this the other day when he was asking me why we were spending so much time on state forest land. So here's the big tall tree, the federal lands. The next one is large commercial landowners, 22% of Oregon's forest land. The next is non-industrial private landowners at 16%. State, counties, municipalities, 4%. State forest land is less than 3% of Oregon's forest land. You are not going to solve the mill problem, the capacity problem, the supply problem for Oregon's forest industry on the backs of the state forest. You aren't going to get there. And it puts a lot of other resources that many other Oregonians depend on, like clean water and fishing and wildlife and recreation, it puts those at risk to try to solve this mill, this log capacity problem for the state of Oregon. If the industry needs to get logs, perhaps it should go to Plum Creek and some of these other companies that are divesting themselves of large tracts that are going to end up in rural development. There's other places to solve this problem, and I also want to comment on that the federal lands, obviously, that situation with the Northwest Forest Plan is part of the reason we're here today, because there's a lot of angst over getting at these state forest lands. These are simply not going to be the place you solve that problem, whether it's Prineville or Willamina or down at Cave Junction.
I don't want to assume we've got a lot of other people that need to talk, so we'll have to defer it. Thank you all.
So I thought you better keep my mouth shut.
So our next group is Tom Wolf, Bob Reese, and Dave Eidenhoff. Oh, wait, sorry. And Trey, is it Cardison? Sorry about that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Here's just a question, and I asked that. We are going to get copies of these presentations they made, are we not?
Yeah, I think Dave's is the only one we didn't get, so.
Okay. Yeah, we'll try to get them. Yeah.
I mean, you had some fairly interesting figures on it. I seem to contradict
some of the others.
And I guess I will ask you to try to keep it. That was kind of an hour for the panel. We need to keep it down a little bit more than that. Or we're not going to get through a lot of the testimony. Okay. Whoever wants to start.
Chair Rublin,
subgroup
committee members. My name is Tom Wolf, and I assure you that the three of us will be much briefer than our predecessors. We're much less verbose than the threesome that was up there. I represent the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited, and Trout Unlimited is a cold water conservation group composed of fishermen. We represent 165,000 members nationwide and 4,000 here in the state of Oregon. Our organization feels this bill if passed would have a detrimental effect on the salmon habitat in the Tillamook and Clatsop State forests that will lead to major negative impacts both on angling and economic opportunities for the local county. Trout Unlimited has a history of working with private industry, with private lands, with state agencies, and working for a common solution. And I currently have sat in the past on a State Forest Advisory Committee. I've worked closely with ODFW on many of their committees for the last 15 years, as have many other Trout Unlimited members. And I just want to state that we feel that other solutions should be reached here. During the fall every year, if you go down to the bays of Tillamook and Clatsop State Forests, state counties, that the state forests feed into, you can literally walk across some of those bays on boats that are fishing for fall Chinook and won't touch the water. Those fisheries provide millions of dollars for the coastal economy, as does the wild steelhead and cove fisheries. Fall Chinook, which are the gem of the fishing industry on the North Coast, are what we call an ocean fish. The fall Chinook, they, after hatching from the gravel, they, after their egg sacs go away in about 3 months, they head straight down to the ocean. They don't stick around. They head out and start their life cycle. So they are not greatly dependent on shade quotas. What they are dependent on is that sediment caused from excessive logging from under industries will cover the gravel and not allow them to spawn on time and or not spawn at all. So therefore, if you raise the logging impacts anyway, buffers, the current buffers that we have designed on our safers are designed for shading. They're not designed to prevent sedimentation flowing in from other logging operations, and it will affect the economy. If you look in the back of what I passed out, I have attached a report from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife showing the economic impact of fishing in Oregon. Fishing in Oregon, and this was done in 2002, is a $500 million industry. Now, I don't have any breakdowns for Tillamook and Clatsop County, but you rest assured that a lot of this money goes into restaurants, to guides, and it's a major impact. The streams and bays of Clatsop Tillamook counties are a major source of angling opportunities for Washington County anglers. For Washington County anglers, the Sandy and many other rivers are an hour and a half away. For us, the Wilson, the Trask, the Nehalem are half hour to 40 minutes away. We fish... Washington County anglers fish in Tillamook and Clatsop. When we fish for steelhead, we fish for cutthroat, we fish for chum, we fish for chinook. It's very important to us. And Washington County is the second largest county in the state and is growing at a tremendous rate. Living in Hillsborough, the city of Hillsborough in 1990 had 30,000 people. Now it has close to 90,000. And it's projected to hit 150,000 by the year 2020. We're growing at a huge amounts, and the impact that raising logging will have on these fishing opportunities could be tremendous. As a sixth generation Oregonian I've lived in Seaside, I've lived in Astoria, my parents currently live in Manzanita. We have been in touch with the industry for a long time. My great-grandfather was a logger. My great-grandfather was a logger. My grandfather was a logger. My father worked in the logging industry in the summers when he wasn't coaching and teaching in Seaside and Astoria. We are tied to the forest. I have fished and hunted in the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forests for a long time and love that area. I deeply sympathize with what the counties are going through. Having lived in Clatsop County, have lived in Tillamook County, I'm very aware of the economic problems they face, and I don't want to see them suffer. But I don't think that departing from the current management plan will solve that without having a detrimental effect on angling opportunities, on the wild salmon populations. I'm a great believer in that we should allow agencies to make plans, to follow plans with their professionals. This current forest management plan was put together after a lot of input and shouldn't be departed on just because people disagree with it, whether or not it's the counties or environmentalists. So in conclusion, Trout Unlimited urges that HB 2975 be defeated. It is a bill while we understand the reasoning of it will defeat a carefully crafted forest plan and have a major negative impact on economic and recreational benefits of angling on the coastal streams. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Smith, members of the committee, my name is Troy Karskadden, and I'm a I'm from Tualatin. I'm here on behalf of the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association. I'll keep it brief to testify in opposition of House Bill 2975. This sport fishing industry delivers hundreds of millions of dollars of economic benefit to Oregon, along with thousands of Oregon-based jobs. Oregon's sport fishing industry depends on responsible stewardship of our watersheds and forest resources. House Bill 2975 calls for rollbacks in the standards we believe are necessary for fish and wildlife to flourish in our state forests. Right now, we're only marginally meeting those demands, and I'm sure as you'll find through other testimony that my use of the word marginal is generous. I represent an industry that's heavily regulated, much like the timber industry. These regulations, I believe, were largely put into place to conserve the resource and vital habitat that so many other resources depend on. The result of House Bill 2975 is something we'll have to live with for decades. I don't think that's been talked about. It takes decades to recover forests, yet only days, weeks, and months to cripple a watershed and degrade essential habitat. I hope this committee keenly appreciates the magnitude of this issue and the far-reaching consequences for what amounts to little more than short-term economic gain. The Tillamook State Forest feeds some of the most important salmon and steelhead rearing areas in the state, and for that fact, in the world. We've already seen the effects of timber harvest on these watersheds and the impact on wild fish. These are the same fish that attract anglers from around the world in the fall to experience the bounty these rivers can generate. What long-term economic benefits could be realized with robust, year-round runs throughout these watersheds if riparian zones were recovered, buffers were expanded, and habitat restored? As a fifth-generation Oregonian, it pains me to testify in opposition of an industry that's done so much good for Oregon's coastal and rural communities. But House Bill 2975 takes us in the wrong direction. With salmon and steelhead runs in decline around most of the region, and certainly along the coast, we need to restore and recover habitat, not further degrade it, to assure the future of Oregon's prized fish and wildlife resources. Unfortunately, in the case of Oregon's timber industry, we're dealing with a finite resource that takes a long time to recover. Today, Oregon's doing what it can to keep its timber industry alive. Because of these decisions, water temperatures are on the rise, fish and wildlife are failing, habitat is degraded, and our timber resources are being depleted to a point that we need to move the line even closer to the precipice. That's why we're here today. It's horribly unfortunate given the rich history of timber in this state. Again, House Bill 2975 is a step in the wrong direction, I think. It's a bill we'll feel the consequences for decades, and we can ill afford to threaten our watersheds any more than they've already been compromised. I ask that you continue to balance the other needs of a healthy forest against the short-term economics associated with this bill. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, committee members. My name is Bob Reese. I'm a full-time fishing guide from Tillamook, Oregon, hence my appearance today. I'm president of the Northwest Guides and Anglers Association. I'm a board member on the for the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association, appointed member to the STEP Advisory Committee, and I also worked for the Department of Fish and Wildlife for 7 years seasonally. Some of my job duties included conducting spawning ground surveys on the North Oregon coast. I'm here to testify in opposition of House Bill 2975. Our industry has many regulations, however, we still put conservation as priority one. What is most disturbing about House Bill 2975 is that it threatens existing and future conservation measures for fish. Wild runs of salmon in the Tillamook are at critically low levels. Since 1991, the ability of sport anglers to harvest salmon has been reduced to the point where now we can only harvest one species of the six wild runs of salmonids that return to the North Coast. We lost access to those other five runs of salmon in just a short 13-year span, mostly just due to depressed levels. We now have closed seasons for wild steelhead, wild coho, wild cutthroat trout, wild chum salmon, and even wild spring chinook. Four of these five species have one thing in common. Their life histories require them to reside in our freshwater ecosystems for extended periods of time during the warm summer months. Tillamook County Commissioner Josie testified that you would hear tales of high water temperatures and even stated himself that we shouldn't see temperatures in excess of 64 degrees if we're serious about salmon recovery. Well, last summer, the main stem Wilson River near Lee's Camp and the North Fork of the Trask River reached temperatures in excess of 72 and 73 degrees Fahrenheit. Credible scientists and the DEQ itself states that when water temperatures reach 68 degrees, it is just a matter of weeks before these salmon begin to perish. When the water temperatures reach 70 degrees and above, it is actually a matter of hours before these salmon begin to perish. And it's not just these small segments of streams that are reaching these excessive water temperatures. All seven of Tillamook County's major salmonid-bearing streams have not met the minimum temperature standards for the spawning and rearing of wild fish. And good portions of these watersheds are influenced by management on state forest lands. Tillamook County Commissioner Labhart stated these lands aren't meeting their timber production goals because of an interpretation of the greatest permanent value definition. There is a difference between the revenue Tillamook County commissioners seek from Tillamook State Forest and what the vast majority of Oregonians supported in 2001 during the acceptance of the forest management plan. And you heard a lot about that before, so I'll skip some of my testimony. State forest lands are currently outproducing federal, industrial, and small woodland landowner forests relative to the full suite of environmental, social, and economic values. 2006 state-of-the-art modeling efforts by the Oregon Department of Forestry demonstrated that if harvest levels on these state forests increase from current sustainable levels, there will be effects on fish and wildlife habitat. Last Thursday, one committee member asked how the Board of Forestry might view this legislation. Commissioner Josie brought an initiative similar to this one to the Board of Forestry last November. The board rejected the concept of marginalizing greatest permanent value because it would compromise what Oregonians adopted in 2001 and continue to support to this day, as evidenced by the statewide public opinion poll that you also heard about earlier today. Lower Columbia River coho are now listed on the federal endangered species list. Oregon coastal coho were recently delisted because the state of Oregon agreed to take on the burden of recovery because the federal government was not doing its part. Oregon just last Friday approved the Oregon Coast Coho Conservation Plan. Any modification to forest practices on state lands that already fail to meet the water quality test further jeopardizes the recovery of this species and other sensitive runs of salmon on the northwest coast. The testimony you heard on Thursday contained a lot of language like sustainability, family wage, jobs, economic benefit, and the role these forests have in providing these amenities. These words came from a constituency that is asking for a much higher harvest than these lands can sustain. We ask you to view these lands for what they mean to us and the families that we serve. We ask you to view the role of these lands as the GPV definition now stands, management of a landscape that yields sustainable fish resources that provide family wage jobs and community economic benefit for all Oregonians to enjoy. Now, last Saturday, I took three adults and 2 6-year-old children crabbing and fishing on Tillamook Bay. Our yield was a whopping 2 keeper Dungeness crab. But at the end of the trip, the father told me it isn't the yield that matters when he gets to spend time with his family on an outing that will provide a lifelong memory for his children. These are the children that will be the future stewards of our resource. We just need a resource for them to be invested in. I've had the pleasure of taking Representative Burley, Representative Boone, Representative Witt, and even Governor Kitzhaber and his son Logan fishing on Tillamook Bay. They have all sampled the bounty that Tillamook offers, but my hope was to get them to see what a special gift we have as Oregonians. And finally, a look at the depressed towns of Garibaldi and Depot Bay and Hammond, Oregon, gives you an idea of what happens when our wild salmon don't get equal consideration in natural resource decision-making. The Tillamook and Clatsop Forests are the North Coast's greatest wild salmon hatcheries that require no funding, just proper management. For this, I urge you to oppose 2975 and to encourage Tillamook County Commissioners to seek long-term, responsible, sustainable ways to fund critical county services, and to recognize that the fight over Oregon state forest lands, which are a mere 2% of Oregon's forests, cannot continue. We can't lock up our state forests for any one interest group or beneficiary. State forests can provide a healthy suite of environmental, social, and economic values, but it takes compromise, commitment, and the overall community of Oregon envisioned to do so. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Thanks very much.
Chair Rowland, in and out in 15 minutes.
That was pretty impressive.
Not bad, huh? Thank you.
There's not that many. Steve Kafoury and is it Warren Arney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kafoury. I'm here today with the Wildlife Society Oregon chapter. The Wildlife Society is not an advocacy group like the Sierra Club or Oregon Trout. We are a scientific society of wildlife biologists, and we rarely speak in front of a bill, Mr. Chair, and advocacy either for or opposing a bill. But we are today, and I'd like to introduce Warren Aney, who's the chairman of our legislative committee, who is a wildlife biologist.
Thank you. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I thank you for this opportunity. As Steve mentioned, we usually don't advocate. We do push for the proper use of science and good decision-making through public participation. And I think in this particular case, since this has occurred, we do have a real interest in advocating for support of the current situation rather than the proposed change.
Could you make sure to give your name?
Okay. My name is Warren Aney.
Thank you.
As Steve said, I am I'm a professionally certified senior wildlife ecologist. I have experience with the state, serving with the state agency for 30 plus years, plus years in private consulting and working with forest management issues from the Snake River to the coast and from the Puget Sound to the Umpqua, and But what I want to do today is talk on behalf of my professional society and to emphasize the point that good policy making, good resource decision making occurs when you have good scientific information and a good public participation process. The forest management plans of Oregon, the state forest management plans, do represent several years of work by a range of experienced natural resources managers, including wildlife biologists, and they also reflect participation by citizens, commercial entities, local governments, and conservationists. It contains a number of I think neat features: structure-based management, anchor habitat protection, and adaptive management, for example. They produce we can expect them to produce a sustainable balance among a number of important forest resources and values, including fish and wildlife habitat conditions, and improve biological diversity. And by the way, biological diversity is good for a forest. It promotes forest stability. One important aspect of this forest planning process that the State Department of Forestry has adopted is a good monitoring and evaluation process. This means that as they learn and as they improve, and I think you've already seen some examples of that, they can go back and modify their plan, modify their goals, modify their actions in order to benefit and do a better job based on the experience of recent attempts to do a better job. This also means we can improve our management information for forest management in general, not just state forest lands, but other forest lands. So we see this as an opportunity not just to have better management on our forest lands, but perhaps to have slopover effects that will say we're going to end up with better management on other forest lands, private and federal. Since this current set of plans did use a good public involvement and scientific process, we feel that adopting this proposed change would be a step backwards. We realize that agencies do have to be involved in political processes, but we also realize that when you have a broad range of professional scientific input and public participation, that you should honor that process. If these plans are not achieving sought after results, there is a process that the agency can use, either through annual reviews or, as was mentioned, the 10-year review process, to modify these plans and achieve or modify their goals and maybe achieve a slightly different range of outputs. As I mentioned, of the 2004 ballot measure, the 50-50 ballot measure, this is one area where our society went on record as pointing out some problems with this 50-50 process. We saw this as, again, counteracting the public process and scientific process that the agency had engaged in, but it also would result in 50% of the force being managed for one set of values and 50% of the force being managed for another set of values. This proposed change would have the potential effect of saying, well, 100% of the forest should be managed for primary emphasis on timber harvest. So we would recommend that you trust the state planning process. One final thing, there's been some discussion, and it's not in my statement, but there's been some discussion about the Forest Practices Act versus the forest management plans. How well will if we went to a Forest Practices Act type of management for these state forest lands, what kind of expectations or losses would occur? Forest Practices Act is designed to mainly regulate commercial timber lands, the management of commercial timber lands, to protect a basic set of values such as water quality, which you just heard they're not necessarily doing a good job of, and threatened and endangered species and a few other requirements that are more legal than optional. What you would not see on a Forest Practice Act type management, you would not see mixed ages of the trees on the forest. You would see basically single age management. You'd basically see single species management and not a mix of species. You would not see mature forests, because mature forests aren't producing volume. They're just producing a range of other values. You would not be saving and improving some important and critical habitats for wildlife. You would not be promoting habitat, for example, for a number of native species that are maybe sensitive but are not on the threatened or endangered list. You would not be protecting and improving riparian habitat other than the minimum required, which is not adequate to protect habitat for species other than fish, and may not be doing a real good job of protecting fish either. It's primarily to provide shade for the streams. It doesn't extend far enough to provide values for other species that depends upon this riparian zone, and there's a lot of those. And it would not result in road management that would involve protection for wildlife as well as protection of other forest areas. I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you both. Ray Wilkerson and Jim Geisinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ray Wilkerson with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. We represent private forest landowners in Oregon, and we are here in support of House Bill 2975. More importantly, we're here in support of the counties, and believe that they have a compelling story to tell you, and I think they did a pretty good job of telling you that story in the last meeting. You've heard a lot of numbers thrown around today. Just by way of further introduction, only a handful of our members purchase state timber. The vast majority, three-quarters or more, do not. So except for that minority, our members don't have a direct interest in the outputs of state forests, but they all share a concern about the current management of these forests and see basically a pretty valuable forest asset for the state not being utilized as it could be. The numbers that you've heard, I think the key ones to remember are 180, and these numbers are all a result of what the department has their own modeling process, and this was a very expensive. They spent a couple million dollars with this modeling process, and the, kind of the verdict is in. And has been said, the plan is really not producing anywhere near what it could. And we're not necessarily saying that the option ought to be to go to the Forest Practices Act and manage under that standard. That, I think, ought to be, if I were on the committee, if I were you, I would consider that to be kind of a rebuttable presumption that the burden of proof ought to be in this bill, not necessarily on the sponsors of the bill to prove to you that their case is right, but you ought to look at the facts. And the facts are that the plan is falling far short of what it was, what the expectations were, as you asked, Mr. Chairman, and even farther short of what the land is capable of producing sustainably. And you should ask, I would suggest, you know, why is that? And ask and demand answers. And if you're satisfied with the answers, that the reasons for that disparity is justified, and the costs that are go along with that are justified, then the bill doesn't deserve to pass. But if you're not satisfied with that, the answers to that question, I would suggest that the bill should pass. The Forest Practices Act, again, we're not necessarily saying that that's what the state forests ought to be managed under, but I think there's a perception, and you heard some testimony just now, that that's really kind of a paper tiger and doesn't amount to much, doesn't provide anywhere near the protection environment that is necessary. Well, it's not a paper tiger. The state of Oregon a few years ago did an estimate of what that costs private forest landowners on an annual basis to minimal compliance with the Forest Practices Act. And another number to give you is $55 million a year. That's what the value, basically that's the value of trees that have to be left on private forest land annually every year to protect the environment on private forest land. So we would suggest that, you know, that is not a minimal or a or an inadequate environmental protection. You've heard testimony here today earlier about water quality, about fish, about threats and inadequacies to those values caused by forest management. As somebody just did now acknowledge, there are no listed species under the Endangered Species Act, fish species, on the north coast of Oregon. It's the only portion of Oregon where every place else in Oregon has got at least one salmon or steelhead species that's listed. North coast there isn't, and it's not necessarily because the federal government has allowed the state of Oregon to do the management. It's because of a very thorough analysis of the status of the coastal coho indicated that it is not threatened or endangered. So the delisting decision was based on viability of the species. Again, if you had the time to do it, and I don't know if you do or the inclination, I don't know if you do or not, but if I were sitting on the other side of the dais, I would probe down to find out why. What is the reason for the disparity? What is the reason for the fact that if these forests were managed under the Forest Practices Act, it could produce 320 million board feet a year every year for 150 years, by the way. This is the computer model goes out 150 years, so that's the annual output that could be produced. Could do that. It's only doing 180. And, you know, what is the reason for that? I would like to just offer to you three basic differences between how the state's managing its land and how private industry manages its forest land in compliance with the Forest Practices Act. And these are the ones, I think, are the big-ticket items that cause that disparity. The first one is longer rotations. The forest industry can determine with fairly mathematically precise manner the financially optimal rotation age to maximize basically revenues from the land, and that's in Northwest Oregon is around 50 years. So you harvest your trees at age 50, you plant another crop. Every year you postpone harvest past that financially optimal rotation age is an expensive choice. Now the state has chosen to manage for 80 to 130 years. So the fact that they're not maximizing the financial output, that's one of the big ticket items why there's such a disparity here. Another is stream buffers. Again, we heard testimony about the DEQ and the EPA. You can spend several committee meetings, Mr. Chairman, having lots of people debate the adequacy of the current stream buffer rules under the Forest Practices Act. We would challenge the notion that the DEQ and the EPA have said that the Forest Practices Act is in violating water quality standards. That's a debate that's been going on for years. It will continue to go on. The Board of Forestry responds to that when it's appropriate and upgrades the rules. But the state forest, the management has gone far beyond on stream protection, far beyond what we believe is necessary. Even on very small streams that are just a couple of feet wide, their stream buffers are 170 feet wide on both sides of the stream on fish-bearing streams. That's, in our view, far beyond what is necessary. It's also very expensive. A lot of valuable timber is not harvested in these areas to comply with that regulation. And the third major area where there's a difference between state management and private management is how the state responds to the Federal Endangered Species Act. I think it's very important to recognize, if you don't already, that the requirements the state has to abide by to avoid violating the Endangered Species Act are the same as private land. All non-federal landowners have the same risks and obligations under the Federal Endangered Species Act. There's no difference. And the only obligation is you have to avoid take, which is a legal term of a listed species. So the state... And there's various ways you can manage that risk as a non-federal landowner. And the state of Oregon is trying, and their choice, their preferred alternative to manage that risk is to try to develop what's called a habitat conservation plan. Private landowners don't do that. We're not doing that. We use what's called take avoidance instead. That's an expensive choice also, because basically they're going to have the federal government memorialize the plan in order to get the habitat conservation plan. So the management plans, in effect, would be locked into a federal contract, basically, if they do get that habitat conservation plan. The other problem there is that by having as an objective of state management the growing of larger, older trees, it creates a self-fulfilling prophecy, because you're basically attracting additional species to come in, which exacerbates your ESA problem. You know, I would question, with 57% of the forest in Oregon belonging to the federal government essentially locked up and put in reserves primarily for things like wildlife habitat, why, with only 3% of the remaining or the total forest, the state managing lands in trust for the counties would have that as an objective to manage for wildlife habitat when we've got plenty of forests already set aside for that purpose in Oregon. So this kind of a bleak scenario is not a result on the Endangered Species Act, not a result of the federal law, it's a result of state policy. The state has chosen to go down this path. The computer model now shows what the costs of that are. That state policy can be changed. That's why this bill is in front of you. This bill does not micromanage the forest. It doesn't set harvest levels. It doesn't tell the Board of Forestry what to do. It just sets broad policy guidance. Does that by defining this term, greatest permanent value, in statute, which has never been defined before other than by the board's rule. And it needs to be defined in statute, we believe. And I think the board would welcome some direction from this legislature. They've been struggling with this issue for several years now. And I think a direction from the legislature would be appropriate at this point because that would lead to some resolution of this that will recognize the fiduciary and trust obligation that the state of Oregon has to the counties, and do so in a way that will not do any harm or damage to any public values. We believe, as I'm sure you won't be a surprise to you, that it's a mistake for the federal government to basically set aside half of the forests in Oregon in a non-management status, and we don't think the state of Oregon should compound that error or continue to do that. So, again, I don't know, Mr. Chairman, if you're planning on having the department respond to the testimony that you've heard, but if you had the time or were inclined, I'd certainly, ask them to explain the reasons for the differences between how private industry manages forest land, how they manage, because that is what causes this huge gap. This either $36 million a year or $50 million a year, depending on which two numbers you compare, and determine if those if there are benefits associated with those differences that are commensurate with those costs. And if you conclude there are, then the bill shouldn't pass. But if they're not, then we'd suggest it should. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Chairman Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Jim Geisinger. I work for Associated Oregon Loggers. We represent 1,100 family-owned logging companies and businesses associated with the logging industry in the state of Oregon. And I, too, am here to lend support for House Bill 2975 and the Council of Forest Trust Land Counties. They're the ones that are really paying the price for the shortfall that we're experiencing in timber harvest levels. I have written testimony I'd like to have submitted to the record. I'd just like to take a few minutes to make some observations and some comments about the situation on these state forest lands. Last September, I completed 30 years representing the forest products industry in different capacities in the state of Oregon. I've represented the sawmill community, I've represented landowners, and now contract loggers, and it's been a privilege to do so. But when I started my career, we were harvesting 8 billion board feet a year in the state of Oregon, and that was a sustainable level. Some would disagree, but based on the assumptions that were in place at that time, that was a sustainable level. About half of our federal lands were being managed for timber production back in those days, and not all of it like some people would lead you to believe. We now are harvesting something less than 4 billion feet, and as Ray mentioned, 57% of our forests are owned by the federal government, and they used to produce about half of our total harvest. Today it's less than 10%. And that's what makes this issue so important to the counties and to the industry that depends on our state lands. I think the history behind these two forests is very relevant to the substance of House Bill 2975. And, you know, a picture is worth a thousand words, and I would like to thank my peers from the environmental community for putting some of those pictures of what the Tillamook looked like after it had been burnt and salvage logged some 70 or 80 years ago. It was a moonscape. It was logged in a manner that would not be permissible today, in fact, probably illegal. Every little bit of fiber was taken out of the streams, which we don't do today. Soils were disturbed. Fish habitat was destroyed. And yet here we are 80 years later, and I heard it was the last best place for salmon in North America. More significantly, it's the most globally significant place for anadromous fish after nature and man destroyed it. So if there is ever an example of the resiliency and the renewability of our forest resources in this state, is on the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forest. And I think the plan that's in place undermines the potential of that forest to produce timber in a sustainable and environmentally sensitive way, and it needs to be adjusted. And, Mr. Chairman, I think you made one of the most relevant observations earlier this afternoon that I had already written down in my testimony. If the fish interests were getting over half of what they were told they were going to get out of this plan because the data that went into it was bad, they'd be here screaming. If the wildlife interests were told they were only going to get two-thirds of the wildlife populations that they were promised in the plan because the data that went into the plan was bad, they would be here screaming. If the wildlife interest said, gee, we don't have enough camping sites because you underestimated the demand for recreation in the plan, they would be here screaming. I heard today that this is a three-legged stool and the legs should be co-equal. Well, I would submit to you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, that we only got half a leg. And I think we deserve a full leg just like the other interests. I'd like to respond, too, to the economic analysis and jobs assessment that I heard earlier this afternoon as well. If I understood the allegation correctly, the harvest levels doubled from 80 to 160 million feet, but there wasn't a commensurate increase in jobs. Well, the reason for that was because in 1994, the Northwest Forest Plan was implemented, and harvest levels went from somewhere around 4 billion board feet to zero. The first two or three years of the Northwest Forest Plan didn't produce anything. There was some volume under contract, federal volume under contract, that was available in the mid-90s, timber sales that were sold in the late 80s, but they were harvested in the mid-90s. But when that 93-94 time hit, that's when we hit a concrete wall. So what I'm telling you is while the Tillamook and Clatsop harvest levels may have doubled,
and employment didn't, it was because we were losing thousands of jobs because of the unavailability of federal timber. You know, one of the benefits of getting old, one of the few benefits, I guess, is to be able to bring somewhat of a historical perspective as opposed to a hysterical perspective to this debate. We have halved the harvest levels in the state, and it's had an absolutely catastrophic effect on the rural communities in Oregon. You know, we can throw around all these numbers about, you know, generating a quarter of a million new jobs in Oregon during the time the Northwest Forest Plan was implemented, but they were not the same quality jobs. They have not been family wage earning jobs. And once you get off the I-5 corridor, the problem is exacerbated. Rural Oregon today is still dependent on natural resources. We're not going to have high-tech industries going into John Day or Seneca or Fossil Oregon, but we do have natural resources in those areas that those communities continue to rely on. So please don't throw the baby out with the bathwater and give serious consideration to House Bill 2975. I concur with Mr. Wilkerson's comments, and I won't repeat them. I think he stated the case very well. And my last comment is, unlike some of the other public land debates I've been associated with, the state of Oregon has a legal responsibility to these counties. I think Commissioner Josie made an excellent analogy last Thursday where what would his son say after investing in a 529 college savings plan when he was off to go hopefully to Oregon State. I don't know where he wants to go, but that would be certainly my recommendation. And to find out that his money was gone. That all that money that he was invested was gone. This is exactly what is happening to the counties that the Oregon Department of Forestry holds these lands in trust for. So thank you for your patience.
Thank you.
I just have a quick technical question. Ray, you mentioned $55 million cost for yearly for private forest landowners. Is that pre or post changes from last fall on stream setbacks? In stream classifications. Is that data 6 months old, or is that a recent data?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boquist, it would be before then. Actually, that was done when Measure 7 passed, the predecessor to Measure 37, or before it passed, actually, part of the fiscal impact statement for that ballot measure was an analysis of if everybody that had to comply with the Forest Practices Act filed a claim for compensation, assuming that measure passed, what would it cost the state of Oregon? And that's why they did the analysis, and that was the number. But that was 6 or 8 years ago.
Thank you.
Thank you. That pretty much is Lynn Herring. Lynn is here. Okay. Because that's the last person on the old list.
I should be on the list.
Commissioner. Oh, and Mike. That's true. Those are the two that were on last week's list. And then we have two people on the new list who are more than 100 miles. So let's.
I was on last week's
list. Yeah, you can come on up, too. Okay. And we'll keep it going for a while. It doesn't look like we're going to get to the Elliott.
We're at FERPS, correct? Audubon Society of Portland. Mm-hmm. So are totally.
Yeah, they were good. Yeah. We'll do both of the last two from last week's, and then we'll start.
We're not going to go, right? Louise can go.
Right, Louise can go. Thanks, Louise. I probably should have told you that sooner.
Chair Roblin and committee members, I am Susan Ash. I'm in my fourth year as conservation director for the Audubon Society of Portland. We are probably the oldest conservation organization in Oregon. We are also one of the largest. We were founded in 1902 with a mission to protect native wildlife and their habitats, and we have over 10,000 household members. So we actually have a lot more members than that. Just in response, real quickly, my name is Susan Ash. I think I said that. To respond to the gentleman that just spoke, We are here. We're screaming. We are those wildlife advocates, and we're here to scream. You can tell, I'm sure, that Lynn's ready to scream. And I also wanted to respond to one thing that he said, and that is also that there is essentially no federal lands in this part of Northwest Oregon that we're talking about. So that was actually an incorrect statement. There's a very small percentage of federal lands in the area that we're talking about. I'd like to introduce Lynn Herring to you. She's going to read the comments with Audubon Society of Portland. Lynn is our Conservation Committee chairperson, and she has been active within the organization for 26 years. So she's got a depth of knowledge unlike any other with the Audubon Society of Portland. So I'll give it over to Lynn, and I'll be happy to help her answer questions if there are any questions.
Thank you.
My name is Lynn Herring. The Audubon Society of Portland was directly involved in the development of ORS 530, the Greatest Permanent Value Rule, or GPV, and the resulting forest management plans for the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forest. We have retained great interest and have participated throughout the years in the management of these public state forests. We provide these comments to you on behalf of our 10,000 members and volunteers, many of whom watch wildlife and recreate in the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forest. House Bill 2975 would dismiss the current management plans that took nearly 6 years to develop. We put time and energy and served as a primary stakeholder in the development of the Tillamook and Clatsop management plans. These FMPs, based on the concepts of structure-based and adaptive management, were implemented after a broad public comment process, which ironically revealed enthusiastic support from county and timber industry leaders. Since its FMPs produced less revenue than was predicted and never promised, counties developed HB 2975, which would require the Oregon Department of Forestry to manage the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forests primarily for logging to produce revenue for counties. Fish, wildlife, clean water, and recreation would all take a backseat to timber harvests. With the passage of this bill, we could witness a drastic change from a productive forest with multiple natural resource and recreational values into managed tree farms. We feel very strongly that this debate should be solved at the Board of Forestry and the Department of Forestry level, and that forest management should not be dictated by the legislature, but by the experts trained in forest management. Currently, the GPV requires state forests to be managed for healthy, productive, and sustainable forest ecosystems that over time and across the landscape provide a full range of social, economic, and environmental benefits to the people of Oregon. We could not agree more that these three benefits should be balanced together, each just as important as the next. The proposed new GPV definition states that forests are managed primarily for timber production to produce revenue for the county schools and local taxing districts that receive revenue from these lands. We opposed this proposed change. A decade's worth of work by a long list of stakeholders would be made null and void. Counties already receive 64% of timber sale revenues on county-deeded lands in Clatsop and Tillamook counties, 150,000 and 300,000 acres respectively. State forest offices do receive the rest. We strongly believe that counties should instead raise property taxes, and with the recent announcement that Senator Ron Wyden will restore the federal county payments program for at least a year for many of the counties that he represents, we are not facing the emergency counties that the counties would lead us to believe, and that is for the counties that Mr. Josie represents. A recent statewide poll found that 87% of us value our state forests for providing us with clean drinking water, 82% with wildlife habitat protection, 78% for fish habitat protection, and 71% for hiking and wildlife viewing. Economic gain, though important, ranked lower. In addition to providing critical habitat for threatened species like the northern spotted owl and the marble murrelet, these forests play an important role in carbon sequestration at a time when the public and our government are finally beginning to understand that climate change is adversely affecting our planet's health and well-being. This is another economic component well worth evaluating. Our state forests are a living legacy, and they must be managed sustainably for future generations for all Oregonians. Habitat demise threatens birds, other wildlife, and our own healthy living environment. And through better science-based conservation practices and policies, we can protect shared habitat so that people and native wildlife flourish together. Please do not allow these biologically diverse forest ecosystems to be reduced to mere board feet. Vote against House Bill 2975. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have nothing.
I just have one question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Was the Audubon Society involved at all in a position on the ballot measure, the 50-50 plan?
Yes, we were. We were for the ballot measure.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. On today's new list.
Commissioner.
Oh, yes. First, you. Sorry about that. I'm going to keep missing it. Yeah.
Where's the check? I hear all these people talking about the check coming, and nobody seems to have a clue about federal policy.
Yeah.
I'm Mike Probst, Polk County Commissioner, and I'm also was a longtime chair of County Forest Trust Lands, and I was the chair when the plan was negotiated, and I also was chair when the policy was negotiated that we're talking about today. And I'm also the vice chair of the ONC lands, and I've been involved in the discussions and negotiations of the policies that you've been hearing about on the 1 year and also the long-term plan on the federal policies. And I'm also have a degree in forestry, and I also was on the COAT board involved in the studies with the current chair of the Board of Forestry, the long-term, that was a 12-year study, the COAT board. So I do have a little background in forestry and a little bit of background in this particular bill that is in front of you. First off, I would like to maybe start with some history of the gravest permanent value. The counties were involved in that negotiation, and we never did agree to that change, and we didn't like it when it happened. And I was sitting next to Mr. John Hampton during that, and he's the one that told me that that's the downfall of the County Forest Trust lands. And he was very disappointed because he had been a member of the Board of Forestry for his two terms, and he told me walking out of that meeting that there probably couldn't be anything worse happen to the counties than that change. And we didn't like it when it happened, but it was the compromise everybody was talking about. And John explained to me in that meeting, he said he's been involved in this compromising all of his life, and this is what's happening. That's how he explained the compromise. He says, I can't catch up with them. He said, I used to just bend over backwards with the environmental groups to try to make something work. And he said, it doesn't matter what I try to do, I can't catch them. He said, when I do something, they move here. And I do this, and they move here. And he said, Mike, I really try hard on my lands to do a very good job. He said, I've donated lands to them. It doesn't matter. And throughout this process, I have learned what he's talking about. In this forest plan, I've worked so hard to try to meet their concerns, and I found myself chasing them so fast, doing just what he was talking about. We couldn't catch them. The counties couldn't catch them. And I had a conversation with Jim Brown, which he was the state forester at the time, about exactly what John Hampton had told me. And I wish Jim could be here today because I think he probably feels that way now after we went through this. But I can't speak for him. It really got ridiculous. I know Jim strongly felt a change in wording was going to be better for the state of Oregon at that time. I think if he had it to do over, he never would have done it. The whole idea of trying to compromise and make everybody happy sounds great. Bring everybody to the table and make them happy. Well, then we go from that and then into the forest plan. The forest plan was almost completely put together except volumes. And the state kept telling us not to worry about it, not to worry about it. That's what we were being told as counties. We said, we've got to know what volumes we're going to get out of this. That was the very last thing that was put together, was the volumes. And we kept saying, we can't agree to a plan that doesn't have volumes in it, so we have some idea what the county's going to get out of it. We were the ones that pushed to have Dr. Sessions hired, not the state. We pushed that very hard and say, we got to have some idea what this plan's going to produce. So the state hired Dr. Sessions to come in and give us some volume ideas of some different type of plans put together. They had a multiple of different plans, and there was one that was picked, and we said we could live with that one. And we could accept this plan, and that was the one that produced 279 million board feet a year. If it produces that, we can live with this plan. And we got, the meeting was down in Southern Oregon, and we said, if a plan produces somewhere in that neighborhood, we can live with it. Everybody went home happy, the environmental groups, the counties, industry wasn't real happy, but they said, yeah, we'll sign off on it, but it was obvious they didn't like it. That was a compromise for us because we were given a chart that showed by the department that these lands could produce 330 million board feet a year. This is the department's chart, not ours. They originally told us going into this plan, they thought this plan could produce more than that if we went with this plan. Well, that sounded pretty good to us at that time. Well, so we were thinking, okay, a plan that we were told probably could produce more than that, but 279,000, somewhere around there, and knowing that they were thinking it could produce more than this, we'd be there or somewhere above. Sounds pretty good to us. Then when they came out with the implementation plans that were so low, and they went public with that before we ever saw them, we had a meeting with them right away and said, no way, we cannot accept that plan. From that day on, we never accepted that plan. It wasn't what they told us. It wasn't what we agreed to. And to that day on, we've never accepted it. And I don't know how many years ago that was. And we have been trying to work with the department on a change in their implementation plan, which could be changed under the plan. We've tried to work with them on the policy, and we've never gotten anywhere since then. Our only alternative is to come here. We don't want to go to court. We've won every time we go to court. We don't want to go to court. That's ridiculous. You are the people that are supposed to set the policy for them. That's what set the policy to buy the lands. That's what made it clear what we were supposed to do. Before these policies were set, we never had any problems like this. It would make it so clear. I mean, when you talk to each different board member, that they have a different meaning of this policy. They can't agree what it is. Let's make it clear. I mean, if you read it, nobody knows what this means. I can give it to 20 people, and they read it, they don't know what it means. You shouldn't be managing property that way. That's not how you manage property. Nobody manages property that way. You've got to have a clear guideline how to manage property. Let's just clear it up. And, I mean, that you guys are the guys that run the state. Set the policies. Let's make it simple. I have a chart that I've given you that, and I've worked on every level of this. The federal lands, and it shows what the environmental groups have done on the federal lands where they have been involved in shutting those down for timber harvest. The number of acreage and the volumes that they have shut down, and then the state lands that they have gone after and are going after, and then in the state, the private lands that they're going after now. This one lawsuit where they have gone after the lawsuit that affects the road building in Oregon. Now, they did lose that case, but could be under appeal. But it shows the pattern that they have done in Oregon. It appears to be a planned pattern to stop timber harvest. Now, they talk about, well, it's only 3% of the land, this state land. Yeah, but it's the only 3% that's left for county governments. It's very important. Now, there was a little bit of testimony here about what's going on the federal lands. I can tell you what's going on the federal lands. There's going to be a bill submitted by Senator Wyden this week or the first of next week that's going to be a long-term fix. The long-term fix is going to be 100% this year, and it's going to step down 10% a year every year until it gets down to 50%. Counties can't survive on that step down. When we get down to the fifth, that it's going to reduce 10% every year, we have to figure out how we're going to backfill that 50% by various things. You know, may have to be some taxes somehow, like people are supporting here, which we're going to have to come to you for those type of changes, these type of things. I mean, there's going to have to be a lot of different things how counties are going to survive. You know, I was going to spend some time going into some of the economics you were showed up here because they were totally wrong, but some people hit on that, so I'm not going to do that. You've heard a lot of testimony. I've been involved in all of it since day one. And the facts are this needs to be changed.
Thank you. Any questions?
I just have a quick question. Sure. It would be easy for Mike, and I'll paraphrase if you indulge me, Mr. Chair.
Go for it.
I think
we have two more people. So.
But we heard, I mean, the members sitting here on this panel heard less than 2 weeks ago one of our colleagues stand up and say that, you know, one of our good representatives who is working hard at this at the federal level had saved the day and the check's in the mail. We've also heard within the last 24 hours that another one of our good members of congressional leaders, all good intention and all working hard, that, you know, we have an amendment, we have a bill, and we've saved the day, and check's in the mail to the counties. Now, I've been a federal lobbyist for 2 decades. I could give you a couple French words to describe it, but I have a simple question of the good commissioner and maybe a nod from the other commissioner, Josie, in the background. Has anybody from the federal government called and told you that your check is on the way?
No. This has a good chance of getting vetoed by the president of what's being submitted. Very good chance.
Mr. Chair, the bottom line is these are amendments, and they're well-intended, and they're doing a good job. but there is no check on the May. There's no guarantee either one I'm going to get across either floor. There's no guarantee they're going to get through a conference committee, and counties are frankly bankrupt. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you for your patience as well.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Really appreciate it. Martin Niger, and is it Dan Olstead?
Yes.
Come on up. I think you're the only new two that are left. Is there anyone else here that hasn't testified that was wishing to? This is exciting. We're going to get done with all the testimony.
We could put the slip back out there.
Yeah, that's true.
You guys don't have land use tonight, so.
Exactly. We could
stay more hours.
Shall I start?
You're going to start?
Where you go ahead. My name is Martin Nygaard. I live in Astoria, Oregon. I'm going to tell you a little history about me and my family. My dad came to this country in 1922 from Norway. My mother a little later than that. I was born in the Columbia Hospital the year after it was built, 77 years ago. I started logging. Well, my dad and uncle had a rafting grounds on the Skipanon Warrington. I probably was out there when I was 8, 9, 10 years old, so I learned how to walk on those logs. I went to Pacific Lutheran one year to play football. Didn't make the grade. So then I went to Oregon State for 3 years, and Patterson said, you can't get out of here in 3 years. I said, I'm going to get out in 3 years, because I got to go to work. I put myself through college at $1.03 an hour working on the boom. I could make $1,000 a year, and that's what college cost that time. I graduated in 51. Now the parking space at 6 or 7 football games cost me $4,000 a year. My wife and I, we try, and she's a year older than I am right now, but I catch up with her in June. I worked on the boom after college because my dad and uncle were getting old, and by the time the Tillamook burn was getting through, I bought a timber sale in the state of Oregon, and that was in 1958. I was the youngest logger in Clatsop County. Now I'm the oldest, and I'm going to be doing it till they put me in a box. I'm not going to retire. But I love to travel. I've traveled every road of this state, except I haven't ever been to Powers, but this summer I'm going to Powers. We have a ranch at Ashwood that we just use for hunting. But that's kind of the story of my life. I started in 58, and we had Chet Reed was the main forester there. John Christie, who's the only one still alive, and Otto Olson, they were the two foresters. We had a plan. By the year 2000, every acre would be growing trees in Clatsop County. And we were, at that time, able to harvest 110 million feet a year. But we're going to only harvest 100 million. And right now we're harvesting probably 60 million feet. And we know how to grow trees. They said this was bad growing sites. One of the people here said that. It's probably the best growing land, timberland, in the world. We can grow in 50 years standard timber. I don't really know like what's going on right now. We're thinning 60, 70-year-old trees. Going to let them grow till they're 135, I think, or 130. There isn't going to be a mill in the country that can, and that's feeding right into the these people's thing. And even the Sierra Club has come to the State Board of Forestry and said, you're not talking about old growth anymore. They're talking about we're cutting down trees that are too big. Big trees. There's one sale that Boise Cascade bought on Sager Creek. 500 trees, 90 to 100-year-old trees, have to be topped. We've got to make snags. When I first started logging, we had a timber sale boundary. We had to go outside that boundary and cut all the snags within 250 feet of the boundary. Now we're making snags. It's absolutely ridiculous. We figure that those 500 trees are probably 1,500 feet to the tree. $420,000 those trees have at market, at what Boise paid, $565 a thousand. $140,000 of that goes to the state, $280,000 to the county. We get about two-thirds in the county. The state gets one-third for managing. When Guy Boyington turned these lands over to the state to manage, because he didn't know how to do it, the state got 10%, we got 90%. And we got 150,000 acres in Gladsom County. They're growing 0.75 feet per acre per year. So if you take 3 times 150, that's 450 divided by 4, and you've got 110 million feet. Just what Chet Reed, John Christie, Otto Olson said would be growing in Clatsop County every year. We are harvesting 60 million feet. The county, my house is just, we built it about 15 years ago, and I happened to look down to Warrenton where our, we're in the chip, we're the junk dealers of Clatsop County. We buy the junk logs and make them into chips for Weyerhaeuser, GP, and Boise Cascade. We have, I just asked Gal to tell me these numbers when I left. We have a payroll of $4,870,000, 117 employees. The average wage is $41,625. We have 25 people that make over 50 grand a year. And so we're not a big business, but we have a 401 plan. We have a health plan. We're self-insured with our health plan. I have a nephew that's going in for a heart operation tomorrow. Our company pays for all of his things because we're self-insured up to, I think it's 40 grand or 50 grand, and anything over that we're insured for. Plimpton Creek. Years ago, probably in the 60s, we had to clean a creek out. Took all the woody material out of the creek. Then we had to go up maybe 4 or 5 feet on each side and clear the woody material away. The fish kept coming. You could go to Westport and watch the fish come under the bridge in the fall by the hundreds, Plimpton Creek fish. Well, that wasn't the proper way to do it. So we put the woody material back in. We grow the trees along the creek, and the creek is producing fish. The fish keep coming. About 7 years ago, the Fish Commission said these are big creek fish. They're not Plimpton Creek fish. They dammed them off. They don't come no more. It's absolutely ridiculous why they would cut that stream off. I don't know. I think they're trying to keep the fish endangered. The terns is the most prolific bird in the world. There wasn't, 25 years ago, there wasn't one of those screaming things diving in the water at all. Now it's the largest colony in the world, the terns in the Columbia River, eating thousands of fish every year. The cormorants, the water's black with them. And they're not, let's see, how would you say the word? You can't shoot the damn things. It's ridiculous. They eat so many little fish. You know, they're going to be 30-pound fish sometimes, so the boy from Tillamook can catch them. But I don't know how anything survives in that river. And then there were a couple of pelicans that showed up here about 10 years ago. They brought all their buddies up from California. You can't believe the pelicans that are on the Columbia River now eating those little fish. Diving right. We have a dock in Warrenton. We've got 40 feet of water, maybe 45 feet. We've got a 750-foot dock. We could have containers or whatever coming there. We make chips at that place. It takes about 60 loads of logs a day to keep us going. I don't know what else I had to say here. Plimpton Creek was a big thing, and I brought that up at meetings. I was president of the Oregon Logging Conference in 95, and I brought it up at some of our meetings there, and nobody seems to care about Plimpton Creek or the turns. After I first brought the turns and the cormorants up to people, they looked. But I live right on that river. I see them eating fish every day. I think we're doing a very good job in the woods. We could sustain 100 million feet a year in Clatsop County and still have the streams. Maybe Gore's global warming is warming up the streams. We're putting the logs back in the streams with roots on them. The trees are growing. I think 150 feet or something like that on both sides. We're doing what the scientists say to do today. What they said to do in the 60s is completely different than what they say today. But it's frustrating. This many people that we got, and we log in Pacific County across the river, and we build about 20 miles of road a year. I've got two people that came to work in 64. They're retired now, but they love to build road, and they run our eights, our two D8s in the summertime. We've got, I don't know, probably half the people have been with us between 20 and 30 years. We have to hire choker setters all the time, and we're a drug-free company, and they go there. If they can't pass, they got to pay for the drug screening. We pay for it if they do pass. But our operators have been there many, many years. And it's a, what else have I got here? I talked about the birds. I talked about Westport. We give scholarships to all of our employees that have people going to college. I've got a son that's 54 years old. When you get a son 54 years old, you know you're getting old. But I don't feel old. I don't feel as old as I am. Anybody got any questions?
When we vote.
Yeah. We'll have our next person, and then we'll ask you some of the questions if we have any.
Okay. I'm just going to hand out. My name's Dan Olstead, representing Olstead Logging. I, along with Mr. Nygaard here, log for ODF in the Clatsop Forest. A lot of his notes, every one of his notes I agree with, so I'm not going to hit on everything. I'd like to thank Jim and Roy for their testimonies earlier, filling in some holes off of some of the previous testimonies. But we're talking about, and Martin was reflecting on, is rural Oregon and the amount of money that he puts in to Clatsop County on efforts from his logging, and how that builds up families and living wages. I was fortunate enough to go to school in Jewell, Oregon, which was predominantly funded by tax revenues from the timber industry. We're going through our problems now, but we're getting them straightened out, that school district anyway. But my second education, which was at Portland State, was funded all by my family's company, and then I came back to work for them. And I can't think of anything else I'd like to do. I consider myself an extreme environmentalist. I think that every logger around is an environmentalist. There's nothing that we want. We don't want to see anything deplete. We don't want to see anything go away, but we also want to be able to use our natural resources that we have. The Clatsop and Potomac Forest do create the best timber around. A lot of times when you lose markets, world markets like our export market. That just saying, I know that the state doesn't do that. It doesn't export timber, but the private companies around do. A lot of times when you lose that market, it's gone. Pulp market might be one of them. Sometimes it goes up, sometimes it goes down. But the reason why in Northwest Oregon we can contain that market is because our timber is the best in the world. There's no doubt about it. It grows. In the article that I gave you guys, there's four generations of family in a deep creek track. My great-grandfather clear-cut it, and I think it was 1921. My grandfather came back in the 70s and thinned it, early 70s. My dad had a timber sale, and this is the same area, re-thinned it again in the late 70s. And in 2004, 2003, my father's sons, Ed, Matt, Rorick, we've got to thin it. That's saying something about how Northwest Oregon and Clatsop County can grow trees. I drive the roads for the Clatsop Forest every day, as well as Martin does, and you start to wonder how things are going and why they're going that way. He mentioned the Sager Creek sale for Boise Cascade. We are the contractors logging that timber sale right now, and I'm glad we're there, but I know that it's an experimental place that will be, I think it's 300 and some odd acres that won't be touched for another 20 years. It's just kind of, we're going to see what's going to happen. I disagree with that. I think there should be more clear cuts implemented into the Clatsop State Forest, and they mentioned 120 acres being a clear cut. I've never seen, I could be wrong, but I haven't seen too many areas that the ODF has made a 120-acre clear cut. I've seen a lot of 40s and 60, and they're kind of spread out, and I wish that I could see that more in that Clatsop track, because wildlife-wise, we're not only looking at just fish, we're looking at the whole spectrum. Clear cuts are beneficial to some of the wildlife in the forest. I guess that pretty much wraps it up for me, and everybody else is kind of hit.
I'd like to say one more thing. The state has, in Clatsop County, has 150,000 acres. Weyerhaeuser now has 150,000 acres. Longview Fiber has 74,000 acres. Longview Fiber is logging Longview Fiber's 74 acres are producing 50 million feet a year. Weyerhaeuser is at minimum taking 200 loads a day out, and they're smaller logs, probably 3,000 feet to the load, 600,000 feet a day. That's 3 million feet a week, 12 million feet a month, times 12 is 144, and we'll back that back down to maybe 120 million feet because they take a little time off at Christmas, the 4th of July. That's twice what the state is producing with better trees, because the state is producing now 60, doing a lot of thinning. The thinning is costing $175 to $200 a thousand just to put it on a truck. We've got five, six people out there getting five or six loads a day with three machines in the smaller stuff. A clear cut is maybe $100 a thousand. So there's $75 a thousand on probably, I would say, 40 million feet out of the 60 we're thinning. And so that's a big number. And it isn't the State Board of Forestries. It's all the policies that the legislature has told them they have to do. You know, it's those people in the field don't want to do it this way. And I don't know what $75 a thousand is on 40 million feet, but I think it's a big number. It might be $3 million, of which the state would get $1 million and the county $2 million. I think that's all the notes I've got.
Any questions?
I want to thank you for coming all the way over here and talking about this. As many people know, I grew up in Port Angeles, Washington, and I have a lot of family that also comes from Aberdeen, Hope Grim, and Astoria. So that whole logging and fishing industry are important, have been important parts of my life as well, and it's nice to see people who are still doing the businesses that their family started a long time ago in the Northwest. So thank you for coming.
We have cows, and we fish in Alaska, and one son in Fletcher's in Bristol Bay, and so
thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your time. Is there anyone we didn't get a chance to speak who wanted to? Okay. Then we will close our public hearing on House Bill 2975. Committee, we'll reschedule the Elliott, probably not next week because we've got some stuff, and we'll figure out when we're going to do that and have a discussion. And then we will talk with some people and work on a time when we're either going to have a work session or whatever on this one. They'll talk to people as we come along. So, any questions?
Hey, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'm just not aware that the legislature is impeding the harvesting. I think if the committee acts, we'll force other people who are impeding it to take a rational look at life.
Okay.
The Elliott Forest belongs to the school kids of this state. It doesn't belong to those damn birds. And they can be logging 100 million feet into Elliott. And they're only logging about 20 million feet.
With that, we'll close our committee on Ag and Natural Resources. Thank you.